I went to, I think 48 I was born here. Then I went to University of California. And at that time, science was like, you know, the big thing in the 60s. Actually, one devotee reminded me, when we were in high school and stuff, there was this kind of, this science was going to make everybody immortal. But just a few more years, 1960s, you know. And we were actually lamenting for the old people, because they missed out just by a few years. Like, oh, the rest of us were going to become immortal, and they were going to die. So it was really kind of sad, these poor old people like that. Missed out, you know, a few years. And so, you know, I went into a science curriculum at University of California, electrical engineering. And then after about a year or so, I figured out, like, you know, where it was going. Just, okay, I can do this. Just memorizing this, learning that, you know. So then I changed to biological engineering. And then I did surgery on cats and, you know, all kinds of stuff like that. But also, it's basically the same model of reality. And so after some time, I figured out, oh, it's the same thing, you know. So then I changed to psychology. Right? And they were all materialists, too. B.S. Skinner. You know, these stimulus response models, you give the cat some meat. The cat, they had a dog. Pavlov, he had the dog, and he gave him some meat dust, and he salivated. And he rang a bell at the same time, and after a while, just by ringing the bell, the dog would salivate. So they built up all these mechanistic models about how the mind is working, and how we just learn things from, you know, very mechanistic, you know, ways like that. So that model was still, you know, predominant when I was in this university psychology curriculum about 1968 to 1970. There were a few people at that time called the humanists. Humanists. Gordon Alport was there. Maslow, and one more, Carl Rogers, Fritz Perls, Gestalt, and they believed that matter wasn't the ultimate test of things, but human beings were. Humanists, that man is the measure of all things. So that's about as high as they went. But also, that was the time of the Vietnam War. So it was an encounter at that time was, you know, with Eastern culture for the first time, and LSD, like that. Go down. So because of that, there was like a lot of suspicion. There were different realities and stuff. So I graduated. I got a first place prize in psychology. Then I went to Northwestern University, which is in Chicago. It's a pretty good school. But then I began to sit with the whole range of Western thought. Everything. You know, you get your PhD, become an assistant professor, associate professor. And so I was thinking Western knowledge is pretty limited. And my mentor, the person who guides you in your PhD program, John Campbell was his name. He was president of the American Psychological Association, Central Division. And so he agreed with me. He said, yeah, I agree. Western knowledge is pretty limited, you know, like that. So I asked him, well, why are you doing this? He said, well, this is how I make my money. He said, I don't have to believe in it. It's this, you know, professional psychologist. And he was a very progressive guy. Maybe we'll get to him later on, like that. So he actually suggested I stop doing this academic line and look for some other ways of knowledge. You know? So then I was an actor with the Second City for a while. It's one of the best improvisational theater groups in America. I was like an understudy with them. That was pretty far out. The improvisational theater is very, you just get on stage and start making things up. You know, you have to really get in touch with creativity. And they have all kinds of techniques in theater for stimulating creativity. And it's basically a Paramatma yoga, what it is. It was the highest philosophy I came in contact with until I came in contact with Krishna consciousness. Then I got a black belt in karate, Okinawan karate. I'll break the table now. My head. Well, I fought with a dog one time. It was a Doberman pincher, and so it was kind of a draw. You know. His mother called me back. And then finally, I came in contact with Buddhimanta. You know, he had this great Sankirtan devotee, and I got a book from him, Krishna book. When I read that, at that point, I was convinced everything is here. Like, this is wow, this is complete, it's nice. So I took initiation in 1974 and was trying to work with the Bhakti Vedanta Institute, but I was, you know, the treasurer in San Francisco, and they figured no way we're going to let him, you know, escape from, you know, this service. But finally, about 1984, then I came in contact with Swarupananda Maharaj. And the Bhaktivedanta Institute, I started working with them. And that was through until about 1990. Then I kind of took off from the science work. And since I've been doing science preaching all over the world and cultural programs, I again helped with this conference we had for Prabhupada Centennial. The first big conference we did was 86? No. When was the quincentennial, Lord Chaitanya? 84? The
500? 86 was the 86? Closing of for 500 years.
86. Okay. So that was, you know, we had the first World Congress for the Center for Science and Religion. And we had 5 Nobel laureates participating in the conference in the final book, President of the World Council of Churches, Chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission of India, and they're very prominent people and had a lot of international effect. Then there was a conference on the study of consciousness within science in 1990. And that was about 5 years before anybody else did anything. Now there's a regular conference every year at the University of Arizona, a very respected conference. And they said, this is his first conference on this topic. And then we wrote into them and they said, no way, you know, and gave them a whole list of 2 Nobel laureates came to our conference in San Francisco in 1990. And they had this, say, well, okay, you know, you guys did it first. Until that time, the word consciousness was like an obscene word. Like I could say some word now and everybody would like, you know, you said that, you know. And so it was, seriously, if you said consciousness at a science conference, everybody would like, you know, it was like you said, you know, a nasty word like that. It was like, God, he said the C word, you know. But Nobel laureate George Wall, he was saying it just didn't go away. You know, just consciousness didn't cease to exist. And it finally had to deal with it. So I didn't want to go to the conference. It was so boring. But Rasaraj, one of the big, you know, leaders in the Bhaktivedanta Institute, said, no, you work so hard, you have to attend one of the sessions and, you know, listen to what's going on there. And it was hellish, you know. It made one of the most hellish experiences I ever had. For example, one of the topics was consciousness one of the elements of the array of the state vector at the origin of the universe? Think about that. But that's, you know, how, you know, gross and everything else their model of reality is. It's just so gross, so mechanistic. And they're trying to fit, you know, consciousness into it. What is consciousness in Sanskrit? Huh? Yeah, sat, chit, and anda. So they're not even the level of happiness, really. Just trying to figure out, like, how we can know things. You know? So then because of social conflicts in the Bhaktivedanta Institute, which is very common in science, I'm actually kind of a cultural anthropologist, really. I kind of backed out and started doing other programs. But again, in 1996, then I worked on the Second World Congress, which was in Calcutta, and that was for Prabhupada Centennial. And that didn't have so much effect internationally, but in Bengal it had a lot of effect. Bengal, the communists took control. Was his name Basu? We know him. He was a prime minister for many years, chief minister. Something Basu. Moti Basu? Anyway, he took control. The communist party was there. The military side of it, the terrorist side, was called the Naxalites. You may have heard about them. They were killing people and stuff like that. But the regular party was there, and they got control of so many things eventually, like that, bit by bit. And so the whole atmosphere in the university was very communist atmosphere, which is, you know, what's his name? Morty, Basu Morty. Anyway, he apparently said, who's the prime minister in Bengal for so long?
Chief minister.
For a long time.
Jyoti Basu.
Jyoti Basu. Apparently when he was, you know, rising up to power, he said, we're going to bathe Bengal in the blood of Vaishnavas. But this is, you know, before we came along. This is other kind of maybe Vaishnavas who were nailing Shudras to trees and beating them and stuff like that. So, you know, not all undeserved like that. You know. So, very, very anti-religious, anti-spiritual consciousness, at least superficially, there. And so I was going around to the university program. We had some people who were helping us in the university. And one of them told us, gave me his assistant to go around different professors and, you know, ask them, invite them to the conference and put up posters and stuff like that. And it was amazing. Everybody kind of like thought the Communist Party has full control and everybody's in favor of it, but nobody was in favor of it, you know? Had an experience? where everybody thinks that everybody else is like, you know, opposed to something, but actually personally they don't, you know, nobody's opposed to it. So that's about where Bengal was at that time. And a lot of it was ISKCON's influence. And ISKCON was religious and modern and scientific, like that, using computers and all these things like that. So we went to one person's office, he was drinking his tea, you know, looking at the poster, looking at me, you know. Yeah. And I'm just kind of sitting there. And then finally he says to his secretary, "Put it up." You know, my cat says, "All right." So I went to the next office and told him what we were doing. And he'd just been to this professor's office. And he said, "You saw him?" And I said, "Well, yes." He said, "He's the president of the Communist Party in the university." So even he was accepting, you know, again, this is not going to go away. I guess we might as well deal with it, you know, like that. So it was a very good conference. The president of the West Bengal Science Association, S.K. Mukherjee, he got up there in front of all these people and he said, "I've been a scientist for, what is it, 40 years, you know. And we all know that science doesn't answer all the questions." And you're all kind of like nodding, you know. So he says, "So I propose we study science the same way, religion, we study religion the same way we study science, very intelligently, very organized, very systematically." So afterwards I asked him, "Do you ever have much chance to talk like this?" And he said, "No, probably speaking, this is the first chance in 20 years, you know. So in Bengal, it had a lot of effect within Bengal, and it's bringing people up to accepting that, you know, religion doesn't have to be unscientific. One Nobel laureate came to that, Charles Townes, and so on. So that's about it. And after that, I've been doing some individual preaching. We did a lecture program, for example, at Kurukshetra University on the same topic, science and the Vedas. And that was chairman of the Department of Physics, professors, graduate students, they liked it very much. And just now I came back, I was very fortunate, was invited to national seminar on development of science and technology in ancient India, like that, organized by the Department of Ancient Indian History and Culture at Calcutta University. So I went, I was a chief guest right there, right? So I went there, chief guest, and on my left was the president, the vice chancellor of Calcutta University in a suit and tie. On the other side was S.K. Mukherjee, former, you know, president of West Bengal Science Association, a suit and tie. And beyond him was P.C. Tundar, who was also was the Union Minister of Education for all of India, like that, suit and tie. You know? And so I felt, you know, this is before, I felt like a street dog sitting there, like that, these people. And the audience is still all, you know, kind of commenting stuff. They're kind of looking at me like, you know. Afterwards, I found out that they were heavy pressure not to have us come there because what if they'll come and sing some bhajans and say some things. What are they going to talk about in a science conference? You know? But the people we have there is real kind of staunch things. You know? And so I gave this lecture, and then halfway through, people pulled their notebooks out, and started like taking notes and stuff like that. Then after that, for 3 days at the rest of the conference, which is very technical. Prabhupada said, "You scratch any Indian, you'll find a devotee. Scratch any Hindu, you'll find a devotee." You know, so Bengalis, I think, are probably maybe the most religious people on earth, really, in India. So as soon as they got past the superficial thing, they were so like respectful and, you know, buying fruit and everything else like that, and wanting to talk and everything else like that. So I didn't want to get back involved in science. You know, I went through the whole thing, right? I didn't want to get involved in scientific preaching. I find it boring in many ways. And so, but I was being pushed to do this. So finally I asked Tamal Krishnamaraj, I met him, you know, about, is it important? And he, you know, looked me in the eyeballs, you know, and said, "Prabhupada said over and over again for his entire last year, scientific preaching is my number one preaching program." Exactly. Surrender, you know. And then Ravindra Swarup giving a much more kind of gentle discussion of the whole thing. So that's why I became convinced, okay, I got to surrender to it. And I found my position. You know, devotees like Rasaraj can play, if you know him, he's supposed to be I. He can play 3 games of chess in his mind at one time. You know, when he writes, he's a programmer. When he writes the code for program, he doesn't even write it down. First he works it out all in his mind and just writes it all down like that. So on. So he has a very, you know, good mind like that. Sariputta? You know Sariputta? Yeah. His mind, like it's like a scientific mind, like a laser, you know. He'll focus on one thing.
understand Mahajani, okay, so they're focusing on his glasses, okay, they're not focusing on the bridge, okay, I'm focusing on where the bridge connects to the lenses, like that. And that's science. Science means very intense, focused study on one topic in the scientific epistemology, which the Bhagavad Gita says is Shudra epistemology, right? That kind of knowledge, that kind of consciousness, which takes one knowledge as all in all. That's Shudra. I know one thing very well. To get a PhD in science, you have to know one topic better than anybody else in the world. If you ask somebody, are you a scientist? They'll say, doves. Well, what is your area? Physics. And there's only about three branches of physics, like nuclear physics, quantum physics. You say, are you a nuclear physicist? They say, no, I'm a quantum mechanist. And you can say, what's your problem? And they're like, oh, this guy knows. Unless you have a problem, you're not a scientist. You'd be working on some problem like that. It's described as a bureaucrats guarding their desks. It's my problem. Back off. Like dogs, be gone. And usually there's about five people in the whole world who really know what can communicate with you, what you're doing, and usually arguing with half of them. This is actually what happens. So, the scientific preaching, it's a very important field. People, you can talk about many things, but you start talking like scientifically, then people, it's a different thing. Now we're serious. One of the people we were working with was John Searle. John Searle? Yeah? The Chinese room problem? He's a professor at the University of California at Berkeley. And every year, all the professors at the University of California at Berkeley, which is one of the biggest schools in the world, they, amongst themselves, they choose three professors out of the whole faculty, 1,000 professors or something, maybe 500, to be university lecturers. Two university lecturers. And they then give a lecture to all the learned scholars on a topic of their choice. So it's a very prestigious position. So he was elected. He's a philosopher. And he's famous for something which is called the Chinese room problem. There's somebody writing in Chinese characters, and he puts it in a hole, and inside is a man with a dictionary. And he takes the Chinese character, looks up the English character, and passes it out on the opposite side. Okay. So the question is, does the man inside speak Chinese? Right? Yeah. You see? Yeah. So a computer, does a computer speak Chinese when it's talking like that? That's the whole thing about can machines think? Right? And I guess it's not so big of a topic. It still is, actually. Pretty big topic. That we're going to make machines that have consciousness, that can think, that can replace human beings. Of course, in science fiction stories, there's all these things about, machines. Terminator 1, was it Terminator 1, Terminator 2, Terminator 3, Arnold Schwarzenegger. This is all about, machines taking over, and 2001, Space Odyssey, HAL, the computer, right? So he was a very, very big philosopher, and pretty famous, what's it called, dialectician? Arguer like that, logical arguer. So he came to the first conference in Calcutta, and he was very impressed. Bombay in 1984. 86, okay. He came there, and he was very impressed with the intellectual level of Indian people like that. And so I never get questions like this in Berkeley. Amazing. And then there was a panel discussion on consciousness. And Sariputta was there. And so it came down to this battle, this intellectual battle between Sariputta and Searle, like that. And it was heavy, kind of Godzilla versus King Kong. Like that. It was just like back and forth, so intense. People were like, just literally like physically just sitting there, like not moving. And after that, It's probably in the maybe in the book they did finally, the proceedings, the conference, which is out of print. So after the whole thing was over, they came off backstage, and Dr. Searle said, Thompson, I'm not saying I agree with you, but I've talked with a lot of Christians about these kind of ideas, and they're nothing, So not saying I agree with you, but you can play a good game of hardball. So on. So Sariputta is like that. He's a real hard scientist. But Subhadamadhar, for example, he's very, very much in tune with the social atmosphere in science. There's a whole social thing like that and so on. So my area then kind of come around this point here is more in the area of like cultural anthropology, where they kind of develop that way. And I've been doing lectures in South America and many places like that. And here in India, Kurukshetra, and in Calcutta. Yeah, nothing much in the U.S. really, you know, hard science atmospheres. We have an institute now in South America, one lady, Dora Basan Montenegro de Derota. She has 5 PhDs. So she just got her own institute approved at her university, which is a pretty prominent university, Ricardo Palma, in Peru. So she has a thing called the Institute... Oh boy, I'm trying to speak Spanish. Institute for Classical and Oriental Studies. It's a very nice name, you know, Institute for Classical and Oriental Studies. And then with that, then she's trying to, you know, bring devotional consciousness into the whole thing like that, and so on. So that's one base. And, you know, we can actually give degrees and so on through that like that, respective university and so on. So, any questions at this point? Any comments?
Cultural anthropology.
Yeah.
Anthropology is a definition of this word. Actually, it's a Greek word.
Yeah, anthropos. Anthropos.
Anthropos.
Yeah.
Anthropos.
Yeah.
It's man.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah.
So anthropology is the field for a field that studies man.
Yeah. Which people say is impossible because man can't study man. Yeah. But then cultural anthropology is more along the lines of, you know, I can kind of guess I can get into it then directly. Well, these are some things, by the way, published in India recently. Because of Prabhupada, Indians are becoming more proud of their heritage. And honestly speaking, I think we can really attribute it to Prabhupada. One example, there's a thing called the Dwarka Project. Because, you know, our archaeology in India is a big area, there's so much opportunity. And so, one idea is that there was a whole civilization in Dwarka, you know, Krishna, whoever he was. And so when Professor Rao is in charge of this thing, and Indians haven't got a lot of money to do these things, but he has two scuba divers and one big scoop about half the size of this room, and a crane for pulling sand out of the way. That's about, you know, what he can afford. So he went out in the Bay of Dwarka and started pulling sand out of the way. But every time the tide comes in, it goes in about as high as this room. The sand comes in and covers up your scoop and everything else, you know. But in spite of that, he discovered walls. You may have heard this. He discovered gigantic walls in the Bay of Dwarka. Then he began to try and plot them, and it makes a ring. There's like some kind of, apparently there's some kind of sunken island there. This is fact, you know, scientific fact. You know. So we were going from Los Angeles to Laguna Beach, if you know the area like that. It's about a 1 hour ride, I guess. And Swoop Damodar Maharaj was in the back seat with Dr. Rao, the Indians. And he was trying to tell him, we should take our own Indian background. We shouldn't accept this European model, you know, how Indian culture developed. So for the first 20 minutes, Dr. Rao was saying, no, they know, they're the Europeans and stuff, you know. The second 20 minutes, he was saying, well, maybe we also have something to contribute. And by the end of the thing, he was like waking up and saying, yes, you know, why should we accept these Europe meat eaters? He said, these people, you know, yes, we're India. Marabharat Mahanu, you know. And then he started giving all kinds of scientific, anthropological, archaeological reasons to support, you know, the Bhagavatam models and things like that. You know? And actually, this happened many times. The British, Prabhupada said, the most cunning people on earth are British. Never trust an Englishman. You can smile and smile. Stabs you in the back. You know? Both world wars were won because of double agents, right? You know, British. How's it go? British spies. No, German spies were actually British spies. You know, double agents like that. They won both wars like that. So it's like the British did this whole mesmerization on Indians, and they were able to get political independence in 1947. But just now beginning to wake up to intellectual independence. And this conference in Calcutta, again, it came because Swoop Damodar Maharaj organized a conference and Dr. Bandabai picked up on it. And they're showing that zero came from India. It didn't come from the Arabs. They had batteries in India, like, I don't know, 1000 BC or something. Electrical batteries producing, you know, voltage like that. You know? Yeah. When Europeans were still digging in the ground with the pigs for, like, truffles. You know? So a series of small books just coming out in India, you know, discussing these things, and very nice, very interesting, you know, and, you know, and hard data about ancient Indian technology and science. Oh. And because of Prabhupada, Because Prabhupada has faith. You know, the Vedas are true, like that. You know? Whereas they try and date the Bhagavatam at the 12th century, or, you know, other things like that. They adopt the European model of evolution, and we were all sort of cavemen, and gradually discovered how to do this and that. But the Bhagavatam has this different model of reality. You know, supposedly there's a river Saraswati in northern India, but it doesn't exist. Right? It doesn't exist anywhere. So this proves the Vedas aren't correct. But with modern satellite photography, infrared photography, you can see where a riverbed would have been. Because it may not be there, but the water will still collect in that area. And through infrared photography, then you can see it, you know, it's going to dry out slower. So sure enough, when they got this technology, they discovered there was a river, you know, right along where the Saraswati should have been, like that. The Veda is just describing that this Veda was written at a certain time. And the Aryans were not supposed to have come into India, I don't know, like some, not very long ago. They're supposed to have come from Europe. But using Craig super fast computers, you can actually calculate. For example, some rishi will see a lunar eclipse during a certain, you know, certain arrangement of the stars. So it's very difficult to go backwards in time, you know, run the universe backwards to get this. But using super fast computers, you can do this now. And then according to this, the only time it would have been possible to see this would have been 6,000 BC. Right? So many things in archaeology and so on are supporting that the Aryans were here, you know, thousands and thousands of years before they ever were supposed to have come here, like that. So, the invasion theory pretty much is finished amongst leading archaeologists that, you know, the Aryans came from Europe, like that. So now they're trying to say, well, they didn't come from Europe, but there's someplace in between, right? Right? It isn't that India is the oldest civilization, but someplace in between, like that. They're kind of trying to split the difference. So they're looking for a proto-Hittite language. Hittites were kind of the guys that King David was fighting with, or something like that. And so looking for some Hittite language that existed before, you know, the Hittites existed, and that'll be the origin of Sanskrit. So Hidayananda Maharaj, of course, has his, you know, his PhD from Harvard in Sanskrit. And this is the area he's working in. He's going through and showing, no, it's impossible. This is ridiculous to claim that because of the, you know, the different kinds of grammatic things and phonemes and all this very technical work like that. You know? So there's actually a lot happening. We can maybe later on, but he's interested in certain topics in certain areas. You know, but specifically, if you're interested, you know, the lecture I've been doing is based more upon cultural anthropology, and I've given it many times. And many times it's been well received. And I've tried writing it down, and it's been very hard, but I have one thing here called Science and the Vedas. And the bottom half is kind of like an intellectual, academic type thing. And the top half is a commentary by Monkey and Piggy, who are two cartoon characters that come along with you. You're here right now, but they're kind of under control for the most part. You know, see them coming out every now and again. So Monkey and Piggy make a commentary then on, on this kind of more academic aspect of the thing like that. So I got that. So basically, again, this seminar can go on for like 3 or 4 days, you know, like that. But also the lecture I gave, the same thing at the inauguration for the science conference in Calcutta, was a fundamental principle from the Bhagavad Purana, a fundamental principle of science. And the point was that the Western science has a very different way of looking at reality from the Vedic science. There's a philosophy of aesthetics, what is beauty? There's a philosophy of ethics, what is justice? There's a philosophy of ontology, what is ultimate reality? And there's also a philosophy of nature. You know, science is a philosophy of nature. You know, what is nature? What is reality like that? So science is one, you know, view of what is reality. And many different people have different views, and they live quite well. It's not that they cease to exist because they don't believe in science. Tribal cultures in North America, they have different view of reality, you know, like that. But out of all the different topics, these comparisons, one topic that comes up first when we're done here is that the Western view of reality, you know, starts with this bottom-up view, that matter is real, and eventually you go through different ways to come to a spirit. Whereas the Vedas say, spirit is real, and you come down to matter, which is ephemeral. Yeah, always changing, immutable like that. Yeah. So that was the topic I focused on. They wanted a 20-minute lecture, and they asked to increase it by to twice that size afterwards. But it's one topic, very prominent, so I guess we could discuss it now. So the Western model, you may be familiar with this. You know Fred Hoyle? You know him? The chunk, the exploding universe, right? The Big Bang Theory? Okay. So that was, I don't know when that was, what, 1950s? No, a little later. Maybe the early 60s, because it appeared that the universe was expanding. And so then Fred Hoyle, an astronomer, speculated there must have been a chunk, right, that started like that, and the chunk exploded, and therefore the whole universe was created. Now, in the modern world, they've changed the name, the chunk. It doesn't sound very like elegant, you know, like that. So now the chunk is called the singularity, right? It's got a new name, got a tie, you know, got a CD and a Palm Pilot, you know, Walkman and stuff like that. But basically, the singularity is basically the same thing as the chunk. You know? But the singularity was existing before there was time and space. There was no time, there was no space, there was no matter, there was no energy. It's a very, very super philosophical, you know, thing when you get into it. And so then, even though the chunk had no enemies, right? It had no motivation, it had no reason, but somehow or other the singularity changed. And then and it began to, you know, expand. And they measured the changes of the singularity in nanoseconds. They said it's a millionth of a second. The first nanosecond of existence, the second nanosecond. And it goes like, we had different theories about how it went from here to here to here. And then nobody, wildest speculation, can get from here to here. But that doesn't bother them. No problem. They just got to figure out, possibly speculating, how they could have got from here to here. But just, no problem. It's okay, we go on. Yeah. So eventually the singularity was going on, and it was expanding. And you got subatomic particles and different energies. Leptons, fermions, bosons, charmed quarks, pi mesons, all these things. Then you got some atoms, you got heavier atoms, and those congealed and made suns, and the suns threw out stellar matter that condensed and made planets, and the planets cooled down and formed the most nutritious substance on Earth, primordial soup, right? Primordial soup. So there was primordial soup was there, and then either by lightning or some clay pathways, different larger molecules were formed. You know, and then, but finally, you know, it's all by chance. You know, so finally, by chance, you got DNA and RNA. Well, DNA, and DNA is of course the code that holds together everything and allows it to be transmitted beyond. Then by chance, the DNA molecules assembled, and there was one-celled animals, and by chance, they combined together and formed multi-celled animals, and by chance, they were from aquatics, and then some of those came out on the land and looked around and figured it'll never work, went back into the water. Some were like, you know, they call it, you know, impractical or whatever. They stayed. And you had reptiles and birds and mammals and tree shrews and gorillas, and finally, here we are, right? Well, finally you get Neanderthal man. So this is called physical evolution. It's still the model. You go to big museums, you see a walk through evolution. And you know, all these little children going there, you know, looking at these things. And it's still the predominating model of how we got here. Although there's a lot of revolution against this amongst very established scientists now. Yeah. Then, at that point, one scientist named Haeckel, he was a biologist, German biologist, he said, well, okay, we have this evolutionary theory for creation of species. Well, that's probably how different cultures also were generated. Survival of the fittest, right? Biologically, but also culturally. Those races and, you know, and beings, you know, breeding and developing their culture, those who were the strongest, they survived in their struggle like that. So he was a philosopher and a theoretician, and many people following him. But then when one politician then adopted his philosophy and made it into a national political philosophy, you know him, Adolf Hitler, right? Adolf Hitler. So that was the philosophy behind the Third Reich. And Mein Kampf, Hitler's book? Yeah, it means my struggle. My evolutionary struggle like that. And we Germans, right? Oh yeah, they took that philosophy and applied it. The Nietzsche was kind of near somewhere, you know. Yeah. So finally then, yeah, we that's a whole thing. If you're been to Übermensch, Nietzsche has a character called Zoroastrian character, what's his name? Zarathustra, who comes and sees the modern world and how like insipid and useless people are. They aren't heroic, they aren't, you know, striving and fighting for women and prestige like that. Honor. And he goes about to go away, and he says, "I'm. There's a great cloud hanging over man." This is Nietzsche, this is a German philosopher, Feuerler. A great cloud hanging over man, and the lightning is coming, but I am just the raindrops falling on your head. Well, you know, the herald of the lightning, but the lightning is coming, and the lightning will chastise you, and the lightning is the overman, right? The Übermensch, like that. So Adolf Hitler, you know, got to power and said, "Wir sind die Übermensch. We are the overman." Joy, Sieg Heil, Sieg Heil. And they built all these gigantic ships, and you know, and all based on philosophy. So probably saying we have to defeat Maya in the area of culture. All these things was carried out because of this philosophical basis, this idea of who is reality. So physical evolution, cultural evolution. And finally, when we come to psychology, you know, physics, chemistry, biology, psychology, and then finally philosophy. And then so finally, God, according to Marx, is a collective idea generated by people to quiet their fears of the unknown like that. In a very positive way, he was saying religion is the opiate of the people. He wasn't being negative about it. He was actually saying these poor people, they need something, you know. So religion is their drug by which to become peaceful. You know? So this is the Western model, right? This is basically still predominant. It's still, after so many years, after seeing science by coming down, still, most people still believe this is reality. You know? So the Vedic model, this is the second half of the presentation here, starts with Krishna, right? What's Krishna doing?
Creating.
Huh?
Creating.
No, Krishna is not creating. Yeah, Krishna's chasing the gopis around in Radhakund with squirt guns, you know. So he's enjoying these things, you know. But then somehow or other, some idiots, you know, didn't want to serve him. We're all right here, you know. So then he creates, you know, this place where they can carry on their activities. In Spanish, manicomio, madhouse, you know, reform school, mental hospital, like that, you know. And to deal with this, he expands himself as, huh? He knows electric. Who deals in the material world? Huh? Some, yeah, Purusha avatars. Yeah, there's three Purusha avatars. Mahavishnu. Garbhodakshaya Vishnu. Yeah, Vishnu. The superintendent of prisons, the prison warden, and the prison guards. Right? The superintendent of prisons supplies the laws, the materials, all those kind of things. And then a warden moves in and takes all these things and directs the construction. He even uses trusted prisoners to construct a prison. And then Shirdakshaya Vishnu has the prison guards, the cameras, everywhere watching the whole operation like that. You know? So that's the creation. From Mahavishnu is coming. Prakriti or Pradhan? I didn't get it straight. I think it's Pradhan. So in the non-manifested state, the material energy comes from Mahavishnu as Pradhan, like this. Then, Shiradakshaya Vishnu enters into it. You know? And externally we see him as Iron, by Krishna, as the time factor. This is immediately, if you want to catch a physicist's attention to say, oh, the Vedas have very interesting models of time. Oh, yeah? The physicists are, you know, addicted to discussing time, because time is the external manifestation of the Supersoul. Lord Kapila Dev in the third canto says this: I keep myself internally as Paramatma, Shridaksha Vishnu, but externally I am perceived as the time factor, like that. Every single person with any philosophy of nature discusses time. St. Augustine, the famous Christian saint, he said, time seems like the simplest thing. until I think about it. And then I can't understand what it is at all. Right? Can you see time? Yeah, it's very subtle. It's very subtle. So many poets discussing it, you know. So this is one of the very important points about our whole philosophy. We have a very nice discussion. By introspection, insight, intuition, meditation, we can perceive Shirdakshay Vishnu. Shirdakshay Vishnu is manifestation of Sat and Chit. There's no Ananda. You can't have a Rasa with a Paramatma. If you see the Rasa as a representative of Krishna, then you can, you know, have that Rasa. But if this Paramatma realization just means, form direction like that, insight, inspiration like that. That's okay? You can catch that? It's kind of a subtle point. You know? You're not sure exactly. There's no possibility of having a relationship with you, but you can feel. You're never afraid. It will always be there. It will always guide me like that. And your sense of timing is very good. Right? Externally, you see people like that. So sannyasis are supposed to be Paramatma realized, is the idea. Jitatmana prasantasya Paramatma samanita. So sannyasis should have good sense of timing. You know? Yeah. Like that. So, that's, you know, the time factor. So you got pradhan and prakriti, like that. And the motivation for all of us is, all of this is us. We're in the spiritual world with Krishna, and it's a wonderful party, you know, for Lord Sri Krishna, organized by his loving girlfriend Sri Radha. It's his birthday party, and she's organized a surprise party. And it's a beautiful sunny day, and there's ping pong and like that, and swimming pool, and music playing, and vegetarian refreshments, and everyone's having a wonderful time and just trying to please Krishna. But somehow or other, you don't want to please Krishna like that, you know. But it's Krishna's swimming pool, Krishna's girlfriends, Krishna's, you know, ping pong table, and everything. Krishna, 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 you know, like that, you know? So Krishna's so kind that he creates some facility for people like that. So in one corner of the room is a black and white television set. Like that, yeah. This is the Bahiranga Shakti, the external energy like that. And everybody knows the power of television, right? I'm gonna do this insurance form, or I'm gonna read this, or something like that. But if the television's on in the room, right, it's almost impossible. Maybe by example, you know, flying on the airplane, I'm not gonna watch the movie, right? You know. Even if you refuse the earphones, I do that. Still, I can figure out the whole plot, what's happening. Like that, you know? Yeah. But Prabhupada, it's interesting. Prabhupada, when he was with Prabhupada on the airplane, and he said the movie came on, he was trying to ignore it also, but he just could not ignore it. He was kind of watching it like that. But he said, Prabhupada watched for a few seconds and just pulled his papers out, was working, just totally ignoring. And that was, it was like one of these adventure movies with some hero, some spy, like shooting at people and everything else like that. So the boy was watching this thing. And after about 45 minutes, Prabhupada looked up the whole thing, and it was still going on, just like that. And Prabhupada said, "And still alive." And back, right? So on. So Prabhupada was able, you know, not to be involved. But Maya, she has these two potencies. You know, one is the throwing potency. She throws us into the material world. And the second is the covering potency. And we forget about the spiritual world. So what's the subtlest material element? There's five gross and three subtle. The Sanskrit? Yeah, hankar. You know, what is the characteristic of a hankar? Is he going on a run here?
I am here.
Huh?
I am here.
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah, to some degree. We all believe. How many people here believe they're in this room? Yeah, so that's a ankar. We believe that we're in the material world. We believe that we're here like that. We believe that we're in the mirror. Yeah, we believe that we're in a reflection like that. We believe that the television set is real like that. Yeah. We forget everything else like that. Okay. So at that point, everybody enters the material world as Brahma. Panipanet, you know, who says that? And the most intelligent being. And at that point, if you want to, you can get right back out again. Oops, okay. Let me out. But you say, no, you know, I want to have more independence. I want to have more power, more reality. Then Krishna says, are you sure? You say, yes. You say, okay. So then he begins to agitate, you know, the non-manifest material energy, right, with the mode of goodness. You know, give me this, give me that. You know, this is here, it's there, right? So it becomes manifest with the mode of goodness. and the prakriti in the mode of goodness, then it generates the next element. Ahankar. Yeah, Sanskrit. Buddhi, which basically means material knowledge. Right? You're looking at the television set, oh, it's a soccer game, right? It's Brazil against Argentina. I don't know if you're here from South America, like that. And somebody else here. It's Italy. Italy versus Yugoslavia. Okay, very good. It's a good comedy. No? Who are the big competitors for Italy in football?
Football?
Yeah.
Brazil.
Okay.
Spain.
Italy versus Spain, like that. So now you know, right? The Adam and Eve, the tree of good knowledge. So now at this level, you have a body of knowledge. Everybody has a body of knowledge covered by knowledge. The soul is covered by first by identification, then by knowledge. You know? So you know, I know it's a game between Italy versus Spain, right? But there's no desire yet, right? Just knowledge. This is okay. What's next? Yeah, manas. So manas at this point means then you're starting to calculate for profit, you know, like that. His cake is bigger than my cake, right? His samosa is bigger than my samosa. How can I get his samosa? Yeah. Here, okay. Look, it's Govinda Maharaj. Okay, his samosa. Like that. Yeah. Elvis Presley. I don't know. You know. But this is actually carried on in the head. It's interesting. It's like where Prabhupada says, read these things, sharpen your intelligence, and take this Western knowledge and explain it in a better way, right? So everybody has their own area. Okay, use it. Read the Bhagavatam. Get some good background. And you can see all these things, you know. So, in the mode of passion, then you start having desires. Okay, it's Italy against Spain. I'm Italian. My wife bets 20 million lira. How much did she bet? 10,000 lira. I don't know. 100,000 lira.
Yeah, 1,000 lira, you have a cup of coffee.
Okay. 100,000 lira. 100 cups of coffee. You know. 1 million. On the outcome of this game, because she's married to some Spanish guy like that. We've got to win. We're Italians. Hey, okay, come on, Italy. Vive la Russia. Livorno, Livorno. Yeah. So now this is the mind. The mind is kind of, no, not that way. This way, that way. You know, see, now you see you're getting more involved, you're desiring, you're making plans, ideas like this, and so on. And then when it's not successful, when these fools aren't winning the game, then what do you want to do? You want to go right down the field and get a body and get a uniform and show them how to do it. Okay, so the next is the panchabhuta, the five gross elements. And these are where you get gross bodies, like that. Everything else before this is simply basically psychological. The first gross element is sound, space. Everybody occupies space. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. But you can have a body of just space. Space, mind, intelligence, and false ego. These are the Digvijayas. They're only attached to their space. Right? How many people here are touching somebody else right now? If you're touching somebody else right now, raise your hand. See, nobody's... Are you? Who else are you touching? Nobody. Right? The floor, okay, but nobody's touching anybody else. Right? We're very careful to maintain our space. Right? What's the next element after space?
Air.
Touch, air, like that. In traditional Arabic culture, if you're talking to somebody, you have to be close enough to feel their breath on your face. Right? If an Arab walked, traditional Arab came in right now and saw this, he would think really uptight, uptight meeting. Right? Something's wrong here, and nobody's touching anybody else, and it was a typical traditional Arabic thing. Everybody would be on top of everybody else. Somebody would be rubbing my leg, other person would have his arm around my neck, and literally when I was talking, everybody would feel, right? Feel the conversation. You know what I mean? How do you keep an Italian from talking? Tie his hands. It's a joke, right? How can you keep an Italian from talking? Tie his hands together, right? Italians can't talk without their hands, right? Italian culture is much more tactile than American culture. I'm just using my hands so much. So you can see these things, the actual practical realities. You come down like that to different levels, and different cultures are inclined towards different things. Italians are more tactile than British, And probably Greeks are more tactile than Italians. Greeks like to touch more and feel more than...
Yes.
Okay, so you can notice that. And Arabs, I think, maybe even more like that. You know? Next level is visual. You know, and this is where most Western cultures exist. Most modern scientific cultures are highly biased towards visual perception like that. American space is about 18 inches. If you get any closer than this, it means either violence or romance. One of the two. You know, yeah. There's so many studies in cultural anthropology on this. E.T. Hall, these fantastic books, you know, on cross-cultural studies in space and things like that. E.T. Hall. Another one's Marshall McLuhan. There's so many studies, you know, that you can see that the world is actually generated from the mind, like that. Then it goes on down like that. You know, different animals, different bodies are different combinations of these elements. The visual element. Then what's next? Space, touch, fire, vision.
Yeah. Huh?
Water, which is taste. The most gross. Smell, right? And everyone's a subset of the others. If you can smell something, there's studies in psychology on this too, that means it has a certain taste to it, it has a certain visual representation, certain feeling, certain shape like that. You know, there's studies that can support this big model of like this hierarchy and also this subset thing like that. So a dog. Dog is inclined towards what sense? Yeah. If dogs, practically speaking, are almost blind. You can take the lens out of the eyes and it doesn't matter much for his functioning like that. You know, so a dog is walking around his house and his master put in a new mirror like that. He turns a corner and there's another dog in his house. You know, and he goes up and he smells him. You know, it's an illusion, right? Doesn't smell like a dog, it's not a dog, right? Yeah. Your dog comes home. You know, is it Mahajan? It smells like Mahajan. Yeah, it's Mahajan. Yeah. And that's his epistemology. He doesn't care so much what it looks like, what it smells like and tastes like. You know, like that's all. So different bodies have different combinations of these different elements like that. Cats have a lot of sounds, prana. They're very tactile animals. You know. They can jump like, you know, 3-4 times their body weight. They can also see ghosts. What's a ghost? You got a whole model here, philosophy of nature now. What's a ghost?
It's a subtle body.
What does a subtle body mean?
Well, see
the mind. Yeah. Well, does it have to have a shape?
No, necessarily.
No. Okay. Yeah. Could this be a collection of ideas covering him? Now, where's my house? They're gonna find my gold. You know, like that. And so he exists in the psychological atmosphere. Chiteshwar, one devotee, was our ISKCON Ghostbuster. They come from a family of tantrics. And as far as I can tell, he's, you know, about half showmanship, half reality, which is pretty good. So Shmita Krishna, Maharaj, you know him? He's from Sweden, like that. He's a very sober guy, right? You know? And another person, Jnanananda, he's a Sankirtan devotee. He's like the same way, very sober, literal, down-to-earth person. So he told me personally this story. He was in Australia, he was a Sankirtan leader, and there was one Bhakta who was apparently haunted, possessed. And Chiteshwar came there and he said, "Can you like exorcise him?" He said, "Well, yeah, probably, you know." He said, "Who is his closest authority?" And he said, "Well, his Bhakta leader, the Bhakta leader." And he said, "Well, where is he?" He said, "Well, he's driving a car back, you know, from someplace like that, bringing a van back. It's not here." And they said, "Well, why do you want to know?" Because when the ghost leaves him, it's going to try and go to the closest authority like that. You know? And they said, "Well, don't worry, he's about 200 miles from here." And he said, "The physical distance doesn't matter at all. It's the psychological and emotional distance that matters." Yeah? So they exist on this mental platform where there's no space. Huh. Space is produced from the mind. Huh. Yeah. Yeah. So Chiteshwar, Jnanananda told me personally. He was so. He asked him, "What kind of person is he? Is he strong-minded?" "Yeah, he's very strong-minded, very literal guy." I said, "Well, okay, we'll do it." So about 12 o'clock or something, he started this whole fire sacrifice to drive the ghost out. And Jnanananda told me he was driving this van back from Melbourne or someplace, I don't know, Australia. It was kind of a little bit rainy day, and he said he started seeing like these kind of grotesque faces, you know, in the backs of trucks, when he was passing by and stuff like that, kind of like strange things, you know, and then feeling strange. And then he started feeling some real cold in his feet. And it started to go up his legs. And he started chanting, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. And it went away like that, you know. And it would come back again like that. He started chanting again. And then after some time, about 3-4 times, he let it go higher. Very dangerous move. But he let it go higher, he let it go down, he chanted, it would go back away like that, so on. Just went off about 30 minutes and finally it stopped, you know. And he got back to the temple, and then they told him what had happened, and it was exactly the same time as the exorcising his ghost. God. So Prabhupada, keep God. So Prabhupada said, don't discuss him too much late at night, or else he start coming. So I guess, you know, we're okay. But we have a very, very sophisticated model. If you start reading the Bhagavatam and studying it, it's in the second canto, there's some detail, in Lord Brahma's instructions to Narada. Then after that, in the third canto with Kapila, more details. And the thing is, you have to, one of the first principles, basic principles, is this top-down model. That behind everything is Krishna. Right? And you'll find Krishna in everything. Then behind that, the Purusha avatars. And then you go through different elements like that. And, you know, everything is psychological. Everything is mental, ultimately. You know, like Guanam, examples about this. There are high iron workers. Another example. Professor Campbell, remember him? My mentor? I mentioned him. He was a genius person. And he was inclined to be opposed to the materialistic model. The materialistic model is that we see things because the eyes work in a certain way. And they generate certain kinds of patterns in the brain. Therefore, people in different cultures will see the same thing. So he said, no, the software is going to totally override, you know, to a large degree what you see. Different cultures will see different worlds. They'll live in different worlds. They'll hear different things like that. And so he had many experiments. One example of this is Iroquois Indians. In New York, they work on these big buildings, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 stories, you know, like that. And they, you know, assemble them with the girders, these narrow steel beams, about this wide. Because of the Iroquois, I think it's Iroquois, they're very, very tactile people. Just their bias culturally is much more towards touch. So they don't rise up in modern civilization very, very much, because they're inclined towards, you know, experiencing things by touch like that, you know. But on the other hand, they can walk around on these, like, 18-inch wide girders, 20 stories off the ground. Just walk around, no safety belt, sit down side by side, with feet hanging down, having lunch, you know, trading samosas, you know, tossing tools to each other, you know. How many people get nervous being off the ground, two stories, one story on a ladder? Yeah, just imagine being 20 stories off the ground on an 18-inch wide thing. You know? I wouldn't even panic. I wouldn't even crawl. I know. I would just, like, you know, freeze like that, like, so the steel was, like, cutting into my arms. Like, you know? But these guys just walk around, you know? There's a book called The 18-Inch Highway, the book, you know? So when you ask them, you know, aren't you afraid when you look down and with your eyes, you know, riveted on your face, they say, I never look down. Like that. And you can feel it when you're looking at it. It's like, you know, they're using your eyes like a tactile sense. You know, they use their eyes to gather tactile information. You know, another example: somebody who's never driven in a car, doesn't know these things. Maybe you're driving a car, you know, along the road at 100 kilometers an hour like that, and the traffic's passing by like this. The person is in the side of the car, like, you know, and he says, don't the cars hit? Yeah, this far apart, right? And you may say, yeah, sometimes. You know, because we're trained, right? You know, we see the world in a certain way like that. We see things, it's amazing. Another experiment was done in the 19th century and repeated in the 20th century by a really famous psychologist named Leon Festinger. And they gave everybody prismatic lenses that turn the world upside down. So the whole room looks upside down now, like down the water glass, trying to drink the water, you know, it's coming pouring like this. So half the people didn't do anything. They just wore the lenses like that and sat around. And after about, I think it was 2 weeks or something, they took them off and the world was right side up again, you know. Aha, battery power. You know. The other group tried to function. They tried to do things in the world. They tried to, like, shave themselves, looking at the reflection upside down. They tried drinking water. They tried walking, you know. And finally, they could ride bicycles down crowded streets and shave themselves like that. And the world looked right side up. Right? It looked normal to them. So after 2 weeks, and it's no time for a complete neurological regrowth in the brain, you know, to explain this. It's all software. They took the glasses off, and what happened? Yeah, the whole world looked upside down like that. So it took them 2 weeks more to get back to normal vision like that. You know? And the last example I give was Dr. Campbell's. And he had six people come in for this experiment. They all sat down. And he had three lines, A, B, and C. Right? And anybody with normal vision could see that B was the shortest line. Everybody was tested for vision. B was obviously the shortest line. So the first guy, the experimenter would say, "This is a simple experiment. I want you to look at these lines carefully and then tell me which is the shortest one as you perceive it." It was on the wall like this, you know. So the first guy goes, A. A is the shortest. Second guy would go, A, B, C, A. And the third guy the same way. So the first five people would all say that the line was A, shortest line. And the sixth guy would also say the line is A. So then after that, the sixth guy was taken out, and they would say, "Now we're going to ask you again, which is the shortest line?" And he would say, "A." And he'd say, "Okay, now we're going to tell you what's happening. The first five people are all actors, right? And the actual short line is not A. They were lying. So which line, do you actually know which the shortest line is?" At that point, you might think, well, they're being pushed by social pressure. You know, these people all said that, and maybe I misunderstood the instructions. I don't want to appear like a fool, you know, like that. But no, they would say, it's A, you know. And they would say, "Well, no, actually it's B." They would say, "No, it's A." So many times they had to give them a ruler, right? A ruler, and they would sit there like measuring it back and forth like that, you know. So science doesn't like this at all, because science says the material world is real. You can look at it. You can make measurements. You can compare two things and say, this is bigger than this. Right? So if you can't even rely upon comparison of two linear scalars, science is in a lot of trouble for saying that reality is tangible, that reality is something we should start with like that. So there are many, many studies like this in psychology, you know, showing that what is up, what is down, what is bigger, what is smaller, you know, what is close, what is far away. All these things are produced from the mind. You know, limited senses. It can be a limited sensual perception, right? Mistakes in sensual integration, mistakes at the cognitive level of actually just calculating, and finally mistakes in the motivational level, like that. The four defects. You know? So illusion, it happens, but below your level of conscious activity, really. You know. But we're below a level of conscious activity, the world's already being created for us by our culture and so on. So this is kind of the whole lecture I gave in Calcutta. And it's one very fundamental principle, this, you know, this top-down reality. And the thing is, the Christians say the same thing, many groups, that there is God, the Creator, and everything else. There is a material world. But they can't fill in the steps like that. You know, they can't show how you're passing from the psychological levels to the spatial levels, to the tactile levels, to the visual levels like that and so on. You know? But I've given it many times for, you know, psychologists and engineers and everything else, and everybody. And everybody very satisfied and would like that. You know? So, Corey Prashna ahead? Okay. Any questions? Yeah.
Did you give this example of velocity in Calcutta?
Yeah. Yeah. No, they weren't shocked. You know, it's kind of like shocking a water buffalo. You know, water buffaloes aren't shocked by much. Because they are. It's so intense. This conditioning by Western science is so intense. You know, they really, the world is a tangible, real, physical thing for them. You know, like that. And they work very hard, and they get paid money, and they have so much faith in this model. Yeah? Like that. Yeah? Yeah.
Yeah. But then you gave them this example, they must be thinking, this world which we are seeing is not real, it is just created by mind.
So what happens with this kind of thing usually is that while you're talking to them, they can begin to appreciate that there's some alternative view. They can get a little bit of thing on it, but they can't hang on to it. You know? It's like taking somebody to some foreign country. They can appreciate it for a couple seconds like that, but they can't hang on to it. So as soon as you go away, you lose the association. Sudhamara Maharaj told no, Prabhupada told Swarup Damodar Maharaj for scientific preaching, first thing, you should have very nice reception in a beautiful environment, very well-dressed men and women receiving them, offering them honor, respect, like that. You know. Then after that, you should have very nice prasadam. You know. And he even showed them several times and actually get showed him how it was done properly. He said, then you taught philosophy. Right? And people, it worked, it's a fact. After having nice prasadam, nice reception, for about an hour and a half, people have intelligence. They can understand these things for about an hour and a half. And then it's about time for a coffee break. You know, so you can, it's a fact. And after that, they get some more prasadam and they can understand things. And it, you know, gradually it can change the heart. You want one more example. In the mode of goodness, the intelligence is here. Right? You see things as they are. Right? And the activities in the brain are like some kind of activities in the hand, like that. But he's become more passionate than the cathexis, the chitta, goes to the head. You know? Then you're seeing things always in terms of profit, calculation, results, schedules, accomplishing things, you know, like that, you know. Carl Jung, you know Jung? Famous psychologist. He was visiting the Hopi Indians about 1935 or something in America. They're very famous for very nice psychological adjustment. So he said, you know, sometimes when I have different thoughts in my head, and they all kind of like looked at him and moved away from him. So he said, did I say something wrong? And they said, well, you said you had thoughts in your head. Only a madman has thoughts in his head. The same man has thoughts in his heart. You know? There's a black poetess in South Africa. She says, a woman thinks with her belly. A man thinks with his heart. And a white devil, he thinks with his head. So it's cultural anthropology. You see how the mode of ignorance, you're absorbing your senses, sense object, mode of passion, Western people think. And this is where consciousness is. This is where it's all happening, you know. By other cultures, it's just the same as the hand. It's going on in my mind, you know, it's the heart. So really it's a change in heart. The real intelligence is in the heart. And people begin, you know, programs like this with professors, own area. And little by little, the idea starts going out. And you see, like, and you won't see the result right away, but actually you can suspect. The only reason people are making advancement like this is because of Prabhupada. You know? If the ideas are going out there like that and stuff. You know? So on. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Actually, this, the technology prevails in the world, technology, and this, materialistic scientists, they gained influence, mm-hmm. they gained influence because the religions, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism,
Vaishnavism,
Judaism, they didn't have any alternative.
Because actually this, the history of science is also a great big area. And this conference in 1986 in Bombay.
Before coming to India, I thought that I was going to see something much better and this and that.
No, but in the head, the British have got them. The British got them in their heads. But in their hearts, when you start getting back to that level, Indians have a real appreciation. And for these models, and this was kind of reality like that. You know? The Harvey Cox did a very, very nice, he did the keynote address in 1986. And it was called The History of Science and Religion in the West, A Lover's Quarrel. So I thought it would be a terrible thing. But he said, in honor of Lord Chaitanya and Radha and Krishna, you know, he made a very beautiful history. It's very short, but it's very nice about the history of science and religion in the West and when things fell apart and how they fell apart, you know. And you can see that, you know, this is in a certain time, we kind of lost it, you know, and demoniac views became predominant. But of course, in India, Nishankara was also, in certain places, you know, predominant too, you know, and Buddhism, like that, you know. So, anyway, anybody wants to talk anymore? Please. It took us up loud. The fans were roaring. You know.
How in spiritual world there is some corner where it's black and white TV and how dead souls they go there and have fun there. And it's like half, 1.5 years ago I was looking at movies from Netflix.
Yeah, everyone's told me about this. Yeah.
I think this
is
all coming from.
Yeah. There's so many, you know, nice things. You know, Swoop Damodar, so much association with him. He said, Prabhupada told him, there's no reason to do research. You know, he said, you can do it, you know, like that. But he says, no reason. He said, they know so much already. The Nobel laureates tell us exactly the same thing. They know so much, but they haven't got any kind of real good theories now to put it all together. You know, Newton gave so many theories. Put all the data together, and then later on Einstein, de Broglie, James Dean, they came up with new models too, you know. But Charles Townes, Nobel laureate, says that's what's happened now. We have so many facts that don't fit into the current model, so we're looking for a new model, and that's why I'm inclined to come to your conferences, so on like that, you know. So there are so many nice, you know, so he said take their information, sharpen your intelligence on Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita, and then explain the things they've discovered, things they know, and they'll be impressed. They'll be inclined then to understand the whole model like that. So there's so many nice, you know, groups and organizations and movies, you know, that you can use for preaching work like that and so on. Just to take people, you know. Swoop Damodar Maharaj, for example, a lot of times would preach about how to stop smoking. It's nice, you know. And there's like small steps. I guess from working with him, I could appreciate that it's not going to be that everyone's going to become like, you know, shaved up pure devotee in the first time around. You know, a lot of your work is simply just taking people, you know, just a little bit forward, like that. Hey, Kay, it's a good movie. Let me show you Matrix. You know, it's the first time in a person's life you could think that, well, maybe I'm an illusion. I never thought that before. We did a conference in South India in Madras, and that was the second most boring thing I've ever been through. The first most boring was the one on consciousness within the science. But it was so boring for me, like science and all these things. You know? And afterwards, I think it was chairman of the Department of Electrical Engineering of IIT Madras. He said, Swamiji, usually these conferences are so boring like that. You know? But this one was so exciting. You know? And just think, we aren't the body. Right? And he's an Indian. Right? You know, it was never even thought that before. That conception, you could not be the body. You know, so many times, especially, Prabhupada said in science preaching, you have to be very cool-headed. You know, so they're very cool-headed to preach in this area like that. You know, so these are all very good tools. You know?
Yeah. I don't know how to ask this question. We were talking about different levels of how do you say? Of realizing the little world. Different levels of ver la realidad.
Yeah.
So we see reality.
Yeah. Okay.
So for the ones who are in leadership or are in charge of people or guiding people, sometimes we have different, I mean, of course, we're trying to follow the ones who are leaders, they try to follow, you know, rules and instructions.
Yeah.
The reality.
Yeah.
And but sometimes are different, you know, the subjects are a little have different ideas of what is reality.
Yeah.
So how we can, or how the leaders can act in the way that they don't want to lord over the person, they don't exploit the person, you know, pushing forward different ideas. Maybe they themselves, they are not completely sure, because it's not that a leader have all the time the shastras and the guru and the stuff, and they know everything exactly all the time what's going on.
Yeah. Usually when I give us these lectures, I do the first day I do like philosophy of nature, which we just did. The next lecture, a lot of times nice, is then social philosophy, you know, because until you understand like what is reality in the Vedas, it's hard to understand, like, you know, social life, right? As soon as you say, women are less intelligent. Okay. You know. But yeah, the first lecture first, you understand, I'm not a woman. So what is he talking about? What is intelligence? What does he mean like that? You know? Well, in certain ways, you know. So social, just at one point, you know, there are definite gender differences in intelligence. The modern model tries to make everybody just the same. You eliminate all these kind of things like that and so on. But the Vedas say no. You know, men and women have different kinds of intelligence like that. You know? And in different areas, you know, one is better than the other. This is the whole next lecture like that. So what you're asking about is actually social philosophy. You know? And from my readings, like the Bible time and everything else, they give philosophy of nature is like important, but the Bible time mostly deals with social philosophy. Because that's really where reality is, you know. I mean, this Americans, when I was in America, they were terrified of fighting with the Afghanis, you know, because they did see what happened to Russia. And, you know, my God, you know. And there's like these articles that there were so many Russian weapons left over from the Russian, you know, Afghani war, like rocket launchers and everything else. It was just like, you know, pick and choose, like just pick up, you know, rocket launcher this type or that type, and it's below zero weather, and these guys, you know, so they were terrified, really, of having to fight with these guys. And so, in spite of all their high physical technology, right? So how did they win? You know? They won the war, but how? Because of technology? That helped. No, with political science. They formed an alliance with the enemies of the Taliban, the Northern Alliance, and they did all the ground fighting. And they knew what they were doing. Americans are figuring out how to get past the landmines with their high-tech equipment. They say, oh, forget it. Follow the tank tracks. Like, you know, a bicycle. Like, you know? You know? Yeah. So they won the war because of social philosophy, political science, like that. So the Bhagavatam gives a lot of that. I mean, it's amazing how much there is. As far as I can understand, there's more about Daivavarna Ashram Dharma in the Bhagavatam than there is about Bhakti Yoga. You know, there's more about how to spiritualize your social position like that than there is about, you know, about pure Bhakti Yoga, Shravanam, Kirtanam. You know, that's more like other advanced Shastras. You know. And so we have Prabhupada gave us more than there's tons of stuff there. You just go on reading, you'll find so many, you know, so much advice. And then specifically, you know, he also said that Chandika Pandit was the greatest political scientist who ever lived. He also said he's a Mayavadi too. You know, like that. But you read Chandika's slokas and you understand so much about psychology and management and political science like that. So, yeah. But behind it all is Bhagavad Dharma. And if you can understand that, you can cut through all the rest of these things. You know, the more you can take to that directly. Because if you're a devotee and you're dealing with people, as devotees, you know, then you want to serve everybody, right? And as soon as you want to serve everybody, then automatically you're trying to like figure out, well, what is his viewpoint? What is his, you know, position like that? There's an American president, Calvin Coolidge, called Silent Cal, right? He was famous for not saying much like that. He sat at a dinner party at the White House one time with, you know, one senator's daughter here and some of the girl here. And the one girl said, President Coolidge, my girlfriend made a bet with me that I couldn't get you to say three words to me during the whole dinner conversation. You know, what do you say? And he said, you lose. Two words. Yeah? That was all he said to her the whole time. So he said, nobody ever listened himself out of a job. You can talk yourself out of a job, right? Yeah. Nobody ever listened himself out of a sankirtan encounter. Actually listening with your heart to what the person's telling you about themselves, about what's going on. So in management too, if you really listen to people, you know, then you'll be able to tell them what to do, right? So management is mostly just really, really trying to hear what they have to say, you know? And once you hear that, then it's kind of obvious, you know, what the guy's reality is, right? Yeah. Yeah? Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Try this one. Oh, here. 1, 2, 3. Okay.
Yes, sir. At this point, I will talk about the arguments you can never convince anyone. But convince is a miracle. That's really the convincing thing. But they don't understand. It's very attractive.
Yeah.
And also what you say about your preaching confirms the same point. The arguments are just that in the beginning, but you convince the atmosphere with your clothing,
white. Yeah. Yeah. Love. Yeah.
If you love them, they cannot understand it, and then they keep attracting
that. Oh, yeah. Rasaraj at our conference in Calcutta and in San Francisco. It was, you know, the first international conference on study of consciousness within science. So there were two Nobel laureates there, Sir John Eccles and George Wald, and again, Searle, and really super heavy people like that from around the world. Eccles is famous. Actually, he's the kind of person he can debate with about, you know, 10 other Nobel laureates at the same time and defeat them like that. You know, really famous guy. You know? So Rasaraj gave a presentation before this conference, just these people. First the select people, then a couple days later a full open conference of 400 people. So he presented his paper like that. And then you may see sometimes like big dogs will pick up a small dog and like pass him around. all beat on him. So after Rasaraj gave his paper, then one Nobel laureate, super genius professor after another, criticized his paper like that. So he sat down, his paper was upside down in his hands, his glasses were kind of on crooked, sitting there like touching his paper like that. So, but you know, he's devoted, you know. So he went back to the tapes, he listened to everything they said, he had another lady, Jeannie Burns, the professor, help him to deal with all the points they made, all the criticisms. And then the big public conference, he went back and represented the paper, a lot of work. And then I heard E.G. Sudarshan, he's a candidate for Nobel Prize. He was talking to one Indian devotee. Indian devotee said, "Oh, Ravi's paper was very nice, you know." And Sudarshan said, "Yes, it was better than what he made before. And I think the other scholars were pleased with it. But what they were pleased with was not that it was so intellectually sharp that it was going to turn over the whole model of Western physics in one paper, but that he made this effort to please them. And that they saw that. He really listened to what we said. And he dealt with those things like that, you know." Yeah? Yeah.
Yeah. And appreciating his humility.
Humility and determination and respect. And then that's what convinced them. Yeah? Yeah. To listen. Yeah.
So, you mentioned that the ether was related to hearing.
Yeah.
And it seems like hearing tends to most settle from the material, from the gross material. And now that they're finding subatomic particles, are those particles actually related to the more subtle
material? This is a whole thing trying to match up Western physics and Vedic physics and stuff like that. And Prabhupada directly says in the third canto, he says, "I'm not a physicist. You know, somebody who has some general ideas and stuff like that, but somebody who's a physicist, he can go through. You know, has to go through and do this." One time Prabhupada told Hansa Duda, "I am Marx, you are Lenin." And everybody. It was a lot of work. You know, for all of us to go through and try and match these things up so people can appreciate, you know, here's a better model like that for medicine, for everything, you know, like that. So the atom is not an empirical entity. This is one thing that Rasaraj blasted one British philosopher on one time. He said, "There is no empirical science in the ancient Vedas. We looked at it, you know." And he said, "I hope you're not going to propose that the atom is an empirical entity." It's not. Nobody's ever seen an atom. You know, it's simply a concept like that. And particles and subatomic particles are the same thing. You know, because of what we see on our oscilloscopes or this kind of thing like that, therefore we infer that because of this means that's happening, you know, like that. Mm-hmm. So all these things that are coming up with this whole universe is simply a, you know, conceptual thing, and it's full of all kinds of arguments and everything else like that. On the other hand, sound in the Vedas, when we say sound, we're thinking, I picture like some kind of physical picture of a tympanic membrane and anvil and the stirrup and cochlea, you know. I still am very inclined towards visual thinking. You know, because of my conditioning in the West, I can see it changing by effort, by chanting my japa properly and everything else. I can see I'm changing a little bit, you know. But sound in the Vedas, there is nothing you can see at that point, right? You know, so the sound they're talking about is not what makes a tympanic membrane move, that model, right? As far as I can tell, sound is when false ego and the mode of ignorance becomes modulated by meter and accent as sound. Yeah. So not actually, it doesn't match up very well with our Western use of the word and things like that. Space is produced by sound. And maybe more in studying devotees who know music, I don't know that well, Gandharva Ved, it talks about different levels of the ear within the ear, you know, and hearing different levels and stuff like that. You know? But there are studies in psychology which definitely support this fact that, you know, space is you know, sound produces, you know, by certain acoustical things you can produce a certain space, a spatial environment like that. Yeah. So no, actually probably not, you know. One more last thing. Bhagavatam gives this thing about Anu and Tracer Anu. You know, one Anu or one atom is the minimum. It combines together with three atoms, like a two. Okay, with this double atom, and three of those make a hex atom, and the hex atom is the smallest thing you can perceive. You know, so the Vedas, smallest perceptual level, wouldn't be a visual; it would be acoustical. You know, so again, maybe again, this is why I'm saying like it's a whole different way. You can't just look at the Vedas from a Western model. You got to start from their angle of vision. So they're saying the smallest perceivable unit, they mean probably the smallest acoustical arc, not visual arc, right? The smallest acoustical entity you can perceive. And beyond that, Baba, you know, it's all speculation, right? So what is the smallest acoustical experience you can have?
Decibel.
Well, that's a measure of intensity, but duration. What else is this intensity and duration? These are the kind of questions that inspire. Prabhupada says these will be the basis for great research. So there already are studies on things like this. You start looking it up. But if not, you can also make experiments and find out, well, what is the smallest sound we can actually do? There's a book by Max Ernst called Mind Works. And he tried to figure out what is the present moment? How long is the present moment? Okay. What does Western science say? They try to just break it down, type microseconds, nanoseconds, picoseconds, you know. But he said, well, no, there's a certain kind of thing which you experience it as being one thing, one event, you know. So he went through that and he discovered that there's a maximum with Western people about 3 seconds. You know, if something happens within 3 seconds, you can, at the maximum that size, you classify it as an event, like that. Otherwise, it's two events, you know. So then I tried chanting my rounds with 3 second rounds, 3 second mantras. It's about 6 seconds per round, and it was an amazing experience. I could get the whole mantra as one experience of chanting 3 second rounds like that with broader intelligence. Then I could see it kind of sliding off one end, you know, the Hare Krishna off that, and I could push it back over, and the Hare Rama would kind of slide that, you know. But I could actually get the whole thing as one experience, you know. And then I discovered that for 12 years I'd been chanting, I'd been emphasizing Rama more than Krishna, right? Or name Hanuman, I don't know. So then I changed over to Hare Krishna more than Rama, and it was a whole like, wow, you know, I became Krishna conscious, you know. So the more like gross. His second experiment he did was that's kind of thing. Sequential event discrimination. If you have two touches, or two flashes of light, or two clicks, at a certain point they'll come together where you can't discriminate them as two events. Like movies, they take advantage of this. A movie is actually a series of still pictures, right? If it's any slower than 1/24th of a second, you can begin to see like it'll flicker. As you start to see like that, and it's finally slow down to the point where you can actually see distinct images like that. So 1/24th of a second is the sequential event discrimination for vision. So he thought that, of course, you know, vision will be the finest. You know, vision is the best, right? You know, we're all inclined towards that. But his experiment showed exactly the Vedic model. Touch was 3 times faster, finer than vision, and sound was 3 times faster than touch. So the atom, the smallest experience you can have acoustically, is 10 times finer than what you can see, like that. I used to do stage magic, right? And the hand is quicker than the eye. This, yeah, you can do things you cannot see it. You can do something right in front of somebody with your hands; they cannot see it because it takes place in less than 1/24th of a second. Okay? Yeah. Or to put another very gross example: a fighter pilot who is using all of his weapon systems and everything else based upon sound, right? You know, like the enemy sounds like a mosquito. You know, that he can get 10 times as much information as the enemy who's using like visual instrumentation in the trying flight. Okay? So right away, they're very practical, you know, applications of the general principles like that. These things, but the Bhagavatam is just a thing on just general science. That's all it is. It's, you know, science 1A. It's just giving you a general idea, so basically you can go to the spiritual platform. You're satisfied. then you're really willing to go to the spiritual platform. But Ayurveda, Dhanurveda, Gandharvaveda, these all are taking details, but they're based on the same model. You know, Ayurveda is based on the same model of reality and doshas and levels and psychology like that stuff. You know? And then it gets into like details, different kinds of pharmaceuticals, different kinds of prana, and this kind of stuff like that. Yeah. Yeah. Your last question, you're kind of
mm-hmm. actually, mm-hmm. When a person decides seriously to
yeah.
practice yoga,
yeah,
I mean seriously,
yeah,
and he's determined,
yeah,
then he's the one who understands,
yeah,
that he understands. About the soul,
yeah,
and because the soul, how you dovetail with the super soul in a manner that the Krishna has inconceivable powers,
yeah,
and I mean this is the way to advance because. To advance in Bhakti Yoga, it's not that I'm going to try to understand.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to understand how this body is working, or mm-hmm. how the three gunas are working, or yeah. how the interactions of the three gunas is not possible.
Yeah.
It's not possible to understand about the interactions of the gunas.
Yeah.
It's not possible to understand about the functioning of the body. And then the person who comes to this, then he gets he understands about the guru, he understands yeah. about the Bhagavad Gita. I mean that I'm talking about my position.
Yeah.
I'm studying the Bhagavad Gita in this spirit.
Yeah. He's in this spirit. I talk about my position. Your body language. Again, you know, from the mind and from the heart. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So Prabhupada, if anybody wants to talk more details about things, and you know, I can be here. And but other than that, thank you very much and good luck.